You're listening to IsraelScene.com. And you're listening to IsraelScene.com. Listening to IsraelScene.com.
Seen through the eyes of Steve, that's myself. And you're on. Two characters passionate about everything that happens in Israel.
IsraelScene.com.
You're listening to IsraelScene.com. I'm Steve, and I'm in Tel Aviv.
And this is Yoram in Jerusalem, and we're doing it this way because it'll be a while before I can get down to Tel Aviv, and I really want to get this report out now. It's quite current and up to date. Steve, I wanted to tell you about, and I sent you down a photo, which I think is on our site, where people can click on it and expand it into a full size. I first saw this in Tel Aviv, and I wanted to have a picture of it, but I didn't have my camera with me, so when I saw it again in Jerusalem, I ran home and got my camera and ran down and took this picture. It sits at a major intersection here. And for those who read the Hebrew, and for those who haven't read their Hebrew for a while, I'll help you. On the top, reading from right to left, it says, Olmert, comma, Higia Hazman Lichor. The time has come, or in our case, has come the time, to choose. And below we see what the choice appears to be. To the left, the choice is a ballpoint pen. To the right, the choice is a bullet. And if you look on the lower left, you'll see that it's signed by Shalom Achshav. The
Peace
red
now.
Is Achshav. The black is the word Shalom. And this really represents, in a graphic way, in a most graphic way, the ideas and thoughts of the so-called peace camp of the left. And it sets up really an idea and a theory, a belief that is so, and as time goes by we realize more and more, distorted, which is that it's our choice. We can choose. We can decide to have peace, the pen on to the left, sign a contract with the Palestinians, or if we don't do that, we will have war, as signified by the bullet. And it just ain't so. I mean, halavai it was. If it was so, we would have had peace quite a while. As a matter of fact, we would have had peace in 1948, because we were ready to sign on the dotted line on a two-state solution, that there'd be a Palestinian state, which included, by the way, a number of mostly or all Jewish towns and villages, and they would have a and we would have a Jewish state, which would include a few of the Arab towns and villages, and we could all go to work on creating our cultures and creating our national identities and so on and so forth.
So explain to me what the mindset is here. Why is it so simplistic for a sophisticated group of intellectuals to demonize the opposition in such a way and immediately imply that if you're not for this particular process and the way it's shaping up, that you're essentially looking to start a war?
Well, I think there are a few elements in this. One is obvious that when you go to an advertising stance, you put up the simplest statement possible, because you have that physical limitation, and you have to make your statement, you know, short and to the point.
But the Arabs do a great job of that, and they that's cartoons.
The right wing. I should have brought. Maybe alongside this could be the banners that are all over Jerusalem that says Mi'al HaKol Yerushalayim, above all Jerusalem. The whole fantasy about having, you know, Jerusalem forever is ours, which actually leads in to the other issue that I think needs to be understood here, which is that none of us, meaning not the Jews and not the Arabs, have really been totally and fully honest with our peoples, our governments, that is, in terms of what's going to have to happen here in order for there to be some peace and quiet. Now, it's not that we can decide there's going to be peace and quiet and do what we need to do and then there'll be peace and quiet. That's part of what I was trying to say to begin with, because whatever we decide to do, it takes the other side to agree fully, not just to agree because we're twisting their arm or because we've blockaded Gaza or because we're going to kill more of them or whatever it happens to be. That's confession under torture, and that's never worked. They have to agree because they have to understand what is in their interest and what is the truth. And the truth is the Jewish people have a legitimate historical claim to some of this land. I don't know how much, I don't know exactly where, but that's step two. Step one is understanding that we have a legitimate historical claim to some of this land. parallel to that is accepting that the Palestinians have a legitimate historical claim to some of this land. And then from there we go on. But without those two bases, there's no start. There's nowhere to go.
Certainly the feelings that I have. I think that if we don't come to that understanding, we have no starting point.
So therefore, the idea that we have the choice, it's Olmert. It doesn't say Olmert Abbas. It just, the sign just says Olmert. You have to make this decision. And I wanted to comment here a little bit about Amos Oz, as a matter of fact, because he just had an item in Ynet that got a lot of play, because he also feels very strongly that it is our decision to make, and if we decide to have peace, we'll have peace, and if we don't decide to have peace, we'll have war. And in a critique of his, I wanted to actually quote Amos Oz himself from March 17th of the year 2000 in the Israeli newspaper Haaretz. And Amos Oz says, and I quote, "The minute we leave South Lebanon, we will have to erase the word Hezbollah from our vocabulary, because the whole idea of the State of Israel versus Hezbollah was sheer folly from the outset. It most certainly will no longer be relevant when Israel returns to her internationally recognized northern border," which is wonderful. I think I'm totally in favor of that, Mr. Oz. I think that is absolutely what should have happened, but we all know that that's not what happened. And we all know that what happened was that Hezbollah, you know, continued to attack us until finally we felt we had no choice but to respond. However well we or poorly we did it, there was no possibility here of simply ignoring and forgetting about Hezbollah in our vocabulary, because that is not what they were interested in. Their interest wasn't in our leaving Lebanon, just like the interest of Hamas wasn't in our leaving Gaza. Their interest is in destroying us. Above and beyond everything else, forget about their state, forget about their nation, forget about their people. Their interest is in destroying us because we are thieves. We have insulted the foundation of their honor. We have come from mostly Europe in their eyes to here to steal their land, because we have, here we go back again, absolutely no legitimate reason to be here other than to steal their land.
So tell me why.
As long as that's their belief, they are obligated to fight against us.
So tell me why is Amos Oz and other well-known intellectuals don't get it? Why don't they get it? What is it that they're unwilling to come to terms with?
We need to go to some form of somebody who understands psychology. My feeling is that it has to do with feelings of inadequacy. If you don't control your life, then who and what are you?
So it's the existential threat that they're unable to handle? Is that it? That they feel so uncomfortable?
They're unable to handle the reality. They're so caught up in the beauty of the theoretical reality of peace on earth, goodwill towards man, you know, and whatever flowering and beautiful. And I know you, Stephen, I know myself, neither of us would object to that if that were what was really, you know, at issue. But it's not at issue, and that's the tragedy. And the other part is that for some reason, they seem to have to feel that we are the ones who control everything. Now, part of the justification is that we are appear to be the strong one. We are occupying the Palestinians. We are in their face. Our army is on their backs. Our soldiers are on their roads and in their cities. Therefore, it's our responsibility. They forget that behind the 2 or 3 million Palestinians sit up 300 or more, 300, 400 million Arabs, and another 700 million Muslims. So the degree to which we are really the strong one in this, I think, is very debatable. And the need to be the strong one is also slightly bizarre in my eyes, particularly on the part of this community of the left that thinks of itself in humanist terms and in terms of being able to grasp and understand the deeper and the subtler realities in which we live. I also found it interesting that in Amos Oz's article in Ynet, and there were all these quick shots of all these people, and it included a quick shot of Yossi Beilin, in which he says, we all know, and this is what Amos Oz says, and everybody here says it, we all know what the deal is. And we all, and when Israelis say we all know what the deal is, they invariably add, and Amos Oz also adds here, alongside Israel, with reciprocal border amendments, without a return of Palestinian refugees to Israel, and with two capitals in Jerusalem. Now, there comes back what I was starting to say before about the posters or the banners, actually, around Jerusalem about, you know, Jerusalem forever. Is we will, first of all, it's in our interest. I think it's absolutely and totally in our interest to leave East Jerusalem and to end our authority and our responsibility over there. There are 250,000 Arabs over there. I cannot understand why, in heaven's name, we need them as citizens of our country. It's beyond me. But what's happened here and what's happened in Palestine among the Palestinians is that the mantras that the leadership have continued to this day teach the population to chant. People chant these things and they believe these things, but there's no thinking behind what they really mean. So the Palestinian leadership has never on any level given voice to the idea that the Palestinians need to learn and accept the fact that there will not be a return of refugees. And on our side, we've had very, very little, very few people willing to stand up publicly and make the statement that there'll have to be a redivision of the capital. I mean, people with responsibility and whose words carry a great deal of weight. Now, Chaim Ramon said that a few weeks or months ago. I think Olmert hinted at it. But here, too, nobody really is taking on the responsibility of educating the public. Part of the reason is that there's such a skepticism that we will actually get to that moment of truth when we will have to indeed give up on Jerusalem, on part of Jerusalem, on East Jerusalem, on Walachi, on Hussein, on Batir, and all these strange places that have been incorporated into the city. Nobody says that. But there are people who hint at it in public. But on the other side of this green line, in Palestine, there is nobody who has said in all these years to the Palestinian people, we're going to have to work something else out as far as the refugees. Lehefech, every time there's a hint that there's a deal going to go down and the refugees are not going to be able to come back to their old homes in Israel, there's an organization of the Palestinian refugees, you know, and they start working again. They start running, you know, seminars and workshops for the children and educational expense stuff and put up billboards and posters, and it's just not going to work. And the, you know, continuing to go through this.
Where is that place? Yeah. Simultaneously, Israel and the Palestinian leadership hammer out behind closed doors a declaration of understanding that, one, that we recognize that there have been refugees from 48 onward through the wars, and we recognize that. And we recognize with which Olmert said, which I thought was very interesting, he talked about the suffering of the Palestinians, which kind of caught Liz by surprise. She was a little shocked that...
Liz, your wife.
Yes, that he was emphasizing that at Annapolis, and I thought that was, quite frankly, a brilliant move. Put it out and just say it. There's Palestinian suffering. We know it. We know the nature of the occupation and the nature of the problem with Palestinian leadership that precipitates the suffering for a variety of reasons. But the bottom line is they suffer. Put that on the table. And they also have to put on the table, like you've been speaking about for the past 10 minutes, about the importance of agreeing and acknowledging the legitimacy of the Jewish state.
It's not only the legitimacy of the Jewish state. It's a historical legitimacy.
Yes, yes.
That's it's not this week. It's not next week.
You know,
I had that conversation with Arikat months ago.
Right.
And he kept saying, you know, and then he said he recognized that Israel as a Jew. The Palestinian people or government, recognize Israel as a Jewish state. Therefore, there's no need for us to go back and recognize the historical legitimacy. And I said, no, you have to. If there's no difference, then why don't you say it in those terms? But he won't say it, and he can't say it. And part of the reason is that now he could come back like a month after our conversation and say, you know, we don't accept Israel as a Jewish state. And then when they jump down on his case, he comes back, and here you go, and he says, well, obviously the Jews are a part of the Middle East, right?
Yep.
He can do that. And then it kind of wiggles the waggle. But if he had said, we recognize the historical legitimacy of the Jewish people claiming a part of the land between the river and the sea, he'd be stuck. They would be stuck. They have not prepared their people for that anymore, that there's a reality to that any more than that they prepared their people for the reality that there will not be a return of refugees, however much that sounds like it's the right thing to do. And in many ways, it is the right thing to do, and under almost any other circumstances, it's the right thing to do. But in this case, it can't happen.
So we had,
it cannot happen.
So we had most of the Arab world sent delegations to Annapolis.
Most that was a victory, by the way.
For whom?
Well, for all of us, us being America and Israel. The victory was that most of those people, with the exception of the Saudis again, who everybody thought were becoming, you know, more accepting and more of reality, is that all those other Arab representatives sat in a room when the Prime Minister of the State of Israel got up and spoke. And if not that many years ago, at the United Nations,
they
when the ambassador of Israel came up to speak in the United Nations, all the Arab representatives got up and walked out the door, right?
Yes.
They wouldn't even listen. So this is, you know, what is that guy who already said, one small step for mankind. I mean, it's like an itsy-bitsy,
teeny-weeny
spider step for mankind that these people would, but it is.
And what I thought was unique is that it caught Iran and it caught Hamas and Hezbollah with their pants down. I think they were absolutely shocked.
Good. Okay.
I mean, so there's an isolation going on there, because ultimately Hamas and Hezbollah and Iran are essentially the adversaries of most of the dictatorships in the Arab world.
Right. Well, that's why we thought that the Saudis were coming on board, and the Syrians, and the Jordanians, and the Egyptians, because of their fear, their Sunni fear of the Shiite Iranians. But I want to tell you that ultimately their enemy remains us. However much they fear the Iranians, however much they're antagonistic to the Shiites, even though that's been going on for forever.
No, they hate us more.
Given the choice, it's like if you put, a few hundred years ago, the Protestants and the Catholics together facing each other, they were murderous towards each other. And they hated each other, and it was like the end of the world that they would never cooperate. Unless there was an outside threat, like the Muslims.
One of the reasons they kept it going was for that purpose, to have an external threat other than Muslim or Arab, which would be much easier for this population to swallow, and the historical hatred of the Jews. So where do you see this going?
Well, I don't actually see this going very far, or if at all.
Is it possible that in the course of this intense negotiations or meetings supposedly that's been committed to by both sides, that we're going to meet almost on a daily basis for a whole year, that in that process those sticky essential issues will have to come to the forefront and will have to be dealt with if they're to succeed and go to the next step?
Well, again, Steve, my basic feeling is that the basis is this understanding. And this is an understanding which the Palestinian, Arab, Muslim world has to come to on its own, in its own way, is that all of these reasons for changing, and reasons for accepting, and reasons for making compromises are all temporary. They're all based on the fact that right at the moment, it reminds me very strongly and very sadly of the statement made by the head imam of the of Saudi Arabia, of the Kaaba, Saudi Arabia in Mecca. When they asked him, what does he think, how could the Muslims make a deal with the Palestinians, make a deal with the Jews at Oslo? And he said, look, we're weak and they're strong. Now the inference, if you understand how to read that, means that when we become strong and they become weak, the deal is off. I mean, that's how all of us work. We all work that way with our landlords, with our children, with our spouses, with our business partners, or certainly with the businesses that are in competition with us. You know, we're very generous when we feel weak and we feel vulnerable. But that doesn't mean that we really believe that, you know, those are the things that we should do, that that's the right way to be, that that's the correct behavior. So there's no real moral, intellectual commitment. There's a commitment for the moment. I promise, Dad, if you only let me use the car, I'll promise you anything.
That is one...
I'm saying that to my second wife when she wanted to end the relationship. I'll do anything. And I would have for a while.
However, there's also, when you're on the strong side of a position and you're feeling confident there's much more room at that place for compassion and for strength to make and for generosity.
Well, that's what the left is saying vis-a-vis Israel, that we are the strong ones and we're the ones with the power. Therefore, we're the ones who have to make the compromises and have to show, you know, empathy and sympathy and all those other...
Well, we can show empathy and sympathy, but if, you know...
Steve, how did you get on the other... I know you're on the other side of the telephone, but how did you get on the other side of the political...
No, wait a minute now. You took it to the left. My position is that if you are on the strong side of the argument, that doesn't mean that you give away the store because you're feeling generous. What happens is that you're in a very strong position that if there's any indication on the other side that there's a willingness to work together, that you can, from a position of strength, be generous and test out the waters because you still hold the power. You
well,
do that because
the
other
lies.
Opposition
that's
has earned your respect in order for you to be able to do that.
And how can you respect the children of pigs and dogs and monkeys, who Allah hates?
Well, I understand that.
You can't respect people like that. They stole your land. How do you respect people who steal from you?
It's a very serious dilemma here.
Truly, truly. Let me give you another example. Yesterday they had Shlomo Abineri, who was once the Director General of the Foreign Ministry, was one of the original supporters of peace with the Palestinians, on the radio and talking to them. And he compared our issue... They asked him, and he agreed that it's very much the same as the issue between Kosovo and Albania. And between this one and that one and the other one and the other one, all the other seemingly intractable conflicts on the planet. And what he forgot was the basis again. And he also forgot it, which really blew my mind, which is that as long as they don't really accept the fact that we have any legitimate right to exist in this form or in any form, what's there to talk about? That's not what's going on between Albania and the Kosovars. They're discussing borders. They're discussing how many are these people and how many are those people, and we can change the government, and we can this much autonomy and that much autonomy. The Arabs aren't interested in changing our government. The Arabs aren't interested in, you know, in changing the way we do business with our name or our flag. If you think if we change the flag, everything would be peachy keen.
The other scenario is the Arab interests are now shifting to wanting to focus specifically on the real enemies, such as Iran. And they're finding that this thorn that they've created, literally, with their people, the Palestinian issue, has to be resolved in some way. And that they're willing to forgo their revulsion for Israel and for the Jews for the sake of making a peace outwardly in the beginning, whereby Israel is no longer going to be attacked from the outside, and that some kind of Palestinian state is developed so that they can get on to what they see right now is much more serious concerns for them and all of mankind. And under those conditions, if there is a cold peace like there is with Egypt, but at the same time there isn't any outward hostility of any serious kind, is that an acceptable peace at this point in time for us?
Well, I ask you, are you intimating that for you, that you think that would be?
To some degree, I think that that would really have to depend on the details and the security arrangements. I'm willing to have a cold peace. I don't have a problem with having a cold peace with Egypt over the years.
My feeling on the cold peace with Egypt is mitigated by the fact that we still have an army.
Well, yes.
If and when the Egyptians change governments and their sentiments change, because part of the reason that they made this peace is that they were needed all this money from America.
Yes.
And America, you know, that was very handy. America sat there and said, all right, here's the checkbook, write the number, and we'll sign. Okay, so they did that.
Right now, America just cut them out of $500 million.
Ah, so what's going to happen next?
Well, we'll see.
But we can afford to wait and see because we still have an army.
Yeah, but they're not mutually exclusive to make some kind of...
Of course they are. Once we have peace, you think people are going to go to the army? We're going to have to disband... We will disband the army.
No, I can't believe that.
I want to tell... Okay, well, we'll have to buy some guys up for parades like Costa Rica.
I think it's real clear that even if
Jews are so deeply involved in wanting to not have an army, Steve. I don't know if you understood what happened here after Sadat came and after Oslo. I mean, there are whole sections.
Well, maybe they will. If you're saying is in fact true, and I don't have any real serious indication that that's the case, but let's assume for a second that your scenario is correct, then most probably what will happen is that we will develop into a professional army.
Well, that's a possibility. Maybe that's what we need to do.
Maybe.
Okay. It's funny. It's funny for us to reverse these roles, but you know, I'll play your game. I'll go along with that. If all of these circumstances, if there is a real and meaningful education for peace process, if there is a real and meaningful re-education, re-propagandizing process in which the legitimacy of the Jewish people, as a religion, as a community, is taught and is accepted, and all the people and all those groups that are willing to kill themselves and kill us in order to stop those processes from taking place, if all those people go on vacation or have the rapture and go up into heaven or something, the Seder, maybe it'll work. It's like the requirements are so complex and are so intertwined and interdependent, it seems like a very, very, very long shot. But here we are, still, you know, going to these conferences, still making every effort, still listening to our leaders saying, and Barak said, and Peres said, you know, now the world will know that we're peace-loving people. Now the world will see how much we're ready to give up in order to make this, for this to work. And on and on and on. And we all know what happened. Nothing.
And maybe nothing will happen again. But I think then when there's any kind of opportunity, I feel we must, for political reasons or otherwise, not be a rejectionist front.
Right, exactly. That's why we're in. That's why we're in. Where?
Annapolis.
In Annapolis, the Seder. There we are.
We're there.
Okay. I mean, I wasn't going to give them any money to buy the ticket. You know. on the other hand, I wasn't going to go out and puncture the tires on the airplane. We went. We'll see what happens. You know, I got an email from a friend of mine, remain nameless, ranting and raving about this is the greatest disaster to the Jewish people in the last whatever. And I wrote back and I said, wait a minute. You know, this isn't going to be fun, but it's not, you're exaggerating. It's not on that level. It's not like a biblical, textual reference to how bad things can be.
So here we got, I received an email this morning from the Anti-Defamation League.
Ah, what are they?
And their take on the Annapolis conference. I'll just quote their third paragraph. They're in a very short four-paragraph statement, which for them is short. Why we think the current effort will lead to a different result? Maybe because the current Palestinian leadership, Abbas and Fayyad, are realistic moderates who genuinely seek reconciliation. Maybe because the Arab states, fearful of Iran and other Islamic extremists, know that they must be newly open to Israel, their true ally in the struggle against terrorists, maybe because the international community understands that Palestinian accommodation is critical to achieve an agreement that can help the West in the struggle against the terror network. Now, I hadn't read this before, and which was pretty much what I was saying in my 2 minutes here. That is a possibility. That is a scenario. The moment in time right now, it may be that critical, a shift of some kind for the sake of
all creation.
See, there it is, for the sake of all creation, which we should tell our listeners is the one line that you have that you use on your cards and on your emails. It always has for the sake of all creation. So there it is.
That's what we're doing here.
Yes. Well, it's been great.
Okay. Another thing I wanted to add, by the way, which I thought was completely outrageous. The list of invitees to Annapolis, and among, you know, all these strange characters, as far as I'm concerned, like Senegal and Slovenia, is one, is Sudan, which I think is totally unconscionable. I think that among other things that can be done without costing anybody any political capital, is really to boycott Sudan from the point of view of the international political world.
Listen, it's not in anybody's interest. You're looking at the truth and the reality of what is happening in the world, and politics does not usually line up according to what the truth is and according to what the reality is on the ground. It creates a scenario of self-interest, and when they line up with certain other people or other countries, they come together to do something with that new reality that they've created. To walk into China and to say to the Chinese, not to mention anything about Tibet, or not to mention anything about the persecution of the opposition, just to get some business, like France just did, you know, a lot of it too, billions and billions of dollars. I mean, there's no justice in the world at that level, at the political level. I mean, that's why in one sense, with all the hasbara, all the public relations that Israel should be doing, or the complaint by many advocates of Israel, is that we're not doing enough, and we're not, but we're not doing enough. The question is, not doing enough to convince whom? To convince who? People who already don't like us, don't like Jews, see Israel as evil? You think that's going to change their minds? I don't think so. There isn't justice here. Sudan serves a political effort on the part of the Arabs to be united, and they also have to be invited. I mean, we could pick off almost every Arab country that was there for human rights violations.
Well, I think that, Steve, that's
and they should be,
true,
but no one's interested. Countries. No one's interested.
You're obviously right.
At that level, you have to play the game, and you have to see, okay, this is the political scenario. How do we protect ourselves in this environment, in this political environment? And I think that's where our debate should be. So, from Tel Aviv, this is Steve.
And from Jerusalem, this is still Yoram.